Support for this podcast is provided by Clark University's International Development, Community, and Environment Department. Administrations change. Global problems persist. Innovate solutions to global challenges like climate change, hunger, inequity, and injustice. Turn research into action. Apply at clarku.edu/IDCE.
Inspired by ISIS, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Terror charges are filed against a suspect in yesterday's pipe bomb attack in New York. He reportedly told authorities he was inspired by ISIS.
He began viewing ISIS propaganda in 2014, meaning that this young man has been essentially following them since their earliest incarnation as ISIS.
Also, former Navy SEAL Kristen Beck says it's time for the U.S. military to do right by its transgender troops.
There are almost 15,000 transgender people serving in the military right now. Not even including people that want to enlist. If you're really there as a government for the people, then start taking care of your people.
Plus, the amazing tale of Charles Robert Jenkins, the American soldier who defected to North Korea in 1965. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. You come here because you want connections, and today we'll find an intriguing connection between Los Angeles and Buchenwald, the Nazi concentration camp. That's coming up later on the show. But we start off by connecting New York City and Dhaka, Bangladesh, densely crowded cities on opposite sides of the globe. And right now they have this in common. In both places, investigators are busy trying to find out more about Akayed Ulla. He's a 27-year-old suspect in yesterday's pipe bomb attack in New York City. Ulla was the only one seriously wounded by the blast, which happened in a crowded tunnel between two Midtown subway stations. We often turn to Rukmini Kalamaki of the New York Times when these sorts of attacks happen. And today I asked her what is known at this point about the suspect.
What we know from the indictment that was filed today in district court in New York is that he very clearly told investigators that he was doing this for ISIS. I think the quote that is in the indictment is, "This is for the Islamic State." In addition, what investigators have learned from interviewing him is that he began viewing ISIS propaganda in 2014. That's 3 years ago. 2014, if you'll recall, is the year when ISIS kind of burst on the scene and declared their caliphate, meaning that this young man has been essentially following them since their earliest incarnation as ISIS.
And do we know anything about his life before 2014?
I don't know much about that. I'm concerned about the security lapse that has occurred here. How is it that this young man was on, presumably, on their Telegram channels, part of their online ecosystem, was researching how to make a bomb as early as a year ago, and yet didn't set off any tripwires that would have led law enforcement to arrest him beforehand?
Do we know if he was in direct communication with ISIS, and did he receive any directions from them?
The indictment does not shed any light on that. In this particular case, it's going to be curious to me if he wasn't in some contact, because again, 3 years is a long time to be on these networks. ISIS is now under the gun by social media companies. Their posts are being taken down very quickly on Twitter, on Facebook. Their Telegram accounts are being shut down. I spend a good amount of my day trying to stay on these Telegram channels to not get kicked off, right? And so presumably, if he was ingesting this material for as long as the indictment suggests, that to me points to him being a member of this online ecosystem. And it's very hard to be a member of this online ecosystem without starting to interact with fellow members.
So tell us what you saw when you were looking at these channels and how ISIS sees this attack. Are they discussing this as a botched operation or a success on some levels?
People are reading into the fact that ISIS has not claimed it as some sort of shame on their part. They're not claiming it because it was not successful. ISIS has claimed numerous operations that you and I would consider to be botched. An example a couple months ago was an attack on the Champs-Élysées, where literally nobody except the attacker was hurt. In ISIS's mind, this is an attack that serves their fundamental purpose of increasing terror in our communities. Now, this particular attack happened on my commute to work. And so most people, I think, reacted in the same way that I did, which is with some annoyance at being late to work. But It did, I think, also cause some panic. And if you look at the New Yorker's reporting on how employees at Port Authority that were working in the shops there reacted, they interviewed a young woman who was so scared by this that all she could do was curl up in a fetal position behind the register of her shop,
wow.
Right? When they see that type of reaction, to them, it's a big win.
There are some reports saying that Mr. Ulla chose the subway tunnel because it's filled with Christmas posters. Is that correct?
That's what officials told my colleagues at the New York Times yesterday. If that is the case, that shows that he's up to date with what ISIS is putting out.
So yeah, what over are they the putting last about, couple of, about Christmas?
I would say for the last, probably the last month, ISIS supporters in their many channels have been putting out poster after poster showing pictures of Santa Claus, you know, with his decapitated head, a picture of Santa Claus shot from the back, tugging his big sack. And in the sack, you can see that he has sticks of dynamite, pictures of Santa Claus in Times Square, pictures of Santa Claus in other well-known European cities, all of them with banners encouraging their supporters to attack. They did this last year as well. And if you'll recall, last year there was a horrific attack in Berlin when a man used a large truck to crush pedestrians at a Christmas market. There was also a foiled Christmas market attack in France from the sources I was speaking to. That was a multi-pronged attack using explosives by several men who were directly in contact with ISIS.
Rukmini Kalamaki of the New York Times, thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Marco. Thank you.
Akayed Ulla came to the U.S. from Bangladesh in 2011 on a type of visa for the children of siblings of U.S. citizens. And following the New York attack, President Trump has repeated his call to end chain migration. About two-thirds of the 1 million people who are granted permanent residence each year came to the U.S. based on family connections. It might not surprise you to hear that this has an impact on the U.S. economy. Dr. Pavan Dhingra is a sociology professor at Tufts University. How long has family-based migration been around, and how does it work exactly?
Well, it's been around for decades, and it works in a pretty straightforward fashion of you migrate, and you then petition and sponsor for your family members to join you. It can be siblings, parents, could be adult children as well. And then the problem has been that there's an incredible backlog. Family members can take years, even decades, to finally arrive in the U.S.,
So make the economy connection for us. You've done a lot of research and written a book about one particular group, one case study, Indian motel owners. How does family-based migration affect that industry?
The punchline I want to say up front is if you get rid of chain migration or limit it severely, you're not just impacting the lives of immigrants, you're actually impacting the U.S. economy at large. The motel industry is a great example of this. So in case your listeners don't know already, about half of the motels in the United States are owned by Indian Americans. It's a pretty startling statistic.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Well, and this would not have happened without chain migration. All these immigrants came from India, starting in the 1940s and 50s. Now, chain migration matters in the following way. I purchased a motel, relatively inexpensive place in Ohio. I then sponsor my sibling to come. My sister joins me with her family. So we're all living in the motel, my family and her family. They help me run the business. They learn the business. I'm saving on expenses. They're getting capital and experience. And then they go off and buy a motel in Arizona. And this is not, I'm not making these examples up. That's actually an example you will hear. And then they'll do the same thing. And this has been how the Indian population came to have a strong foothold in the motel industry, and in the process, we employ a number of local people to be front desk clerks, housekeepers, and the like. And it's also what allowed for local economies to have more tax dollars and et cetera, et cetera.
But if chain migration were to end, wouldn't those jobs and opportunities in the motel industry just go to somebody else?
No, because these owners can't afford to hire people and pay them minimum wage. Now, they do hire staff. They have repair people and the like. But they cannot hire enough people to run the motel on their income alone, on what they're making through renting out the rooms alone. So these motels would close down. The people who are local workers would be out of a job. So no, the answer is not as simple as replacing the family labor with paid local labor.
So I've often been curious about this, like why certain cities and communities end up with concentrations of certain nationalities, like Houston, a lot of Nigerians and Cameroonians, here in Boston, many Haitians and Ethiopians, Los Angeles, Armenians. Is part of the answer to this chain migration, like you have one family that puts down roots in a place and then other family members follow?
Right. It's the combination of chain migration plus local economies. So as you suggested, right, people settle in an area, their relatives come to live with them at first or live near them, and then the local economy hopefully can take them in and give them a grounding. Once an immigrant group gets known to be in a certain kind of niche, whether that be small business ownership, whatever it is, then relatives can more easily find occupations in those same industries. So if a town is known for a certain sector of the economy, then it makes it easier for a group to kind of have a stronger density and presence there.
Dr. Pavan Dhingra, a sociology professor at Tufts University. Thanks for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Think about it. There are a bunch of veterans who've gone on to acting careers. Think of Audie Murphy and Ice-T, but only a handful of veterans have had roles like this.
You coward. You didn't keep
That's Charles Robert Jenkins, just barely in there, playing the villain in an epic North Korean propaganda movie called Unsung Heroes. Yes, an American in a North Korean movie. Jenkins was a U.S. Army sergeant when he defected to North Korea in 1965. Yesterday, he died in Japan. The world's resident history buff, Chris Wolf, has been looking a little deeper into his life. So, Chris, a lot of questions here. Who was he, first of all?
Well, Charles Robert Jenkins was born into a very large, poor, white family in a little town called Rich Square in North Carolina. He didn't have many career prospects, wasn't good at school, so he joined the National Guard by lying about his age at tender age of 15 and joined the regular army in 1958. But as you mentioned, then defected in 1965.
Yeah, and why is the big question here for me?
Well, we can't really look into the mind of a young man who's fleeing away from what you'd think would be the free world. But what he told us at court-martial, he was actually court-martialed by the U.S. military in 2004, was that he was afraid. He was afraid of the hardship and danger of serving in South Korea, and he was even more afraid of being sent to Vietnam. So that seems to be the principal motivation. Plus, he did have about 10 beers, so on that patrol that night, his judgment was probably impaired.
What happened to him while he was in North Korea?
Well, he was there for decades, and it was a nasty, brutal time. You could imagine him almost having some kind of celebrity status, as there were very few U.S. military defectors, but no. They were locked up together in a small cabin and fed very poor food. Here's him, for example, talking in an interview in 2008 with Blaine Harden of The Washington Post.
The rice I ate in North Korea was 7 years old, they told me. Full of bugs, rocks, rotten.
So pretty miserable conditions.
Did he ever have a family in North Korea?
Well, actually, he did. He met a young Japanese abductee. And by that, I mean North Korea had this bizarre policy of sending agents to Japan to kidnap Japanese citizens to bring them back to train North Korea's own spies in Japanese culture and language. And he was introduced to one of these women whom he eventually married and by whom he had two children, Hitomi Soga, and who he leaves now as a widow.
So how did Jenkins get out of North Korea? When did that happen?
Well, that was also connected to his wife, Hitomi Soga. There was tremendous political pressure from Japan around the end of the 1990s, beginning of the 2000s, to get these abductees released. And the North Korean leadership had a change of heart and actually did release some of them in 2002. And a couple of years later, they decided to let Jenkins go to be reunited with his wife. It's an act of compassion, if you can say that, from the North Koreans.
Right. And Jenkins, I gather, chose to live out the rest of his life in Japan. What was his life there like?
It actually became quite a celebrity. None of the abductees wanted to give media interviews, but he was happy to talk endlessly to the Japanese media, and his book was a bestseller. He settled with his wife on the remote island of Sedo off the west coast, and he worked in the gift shop there and was a major draw for the local tourist industry. So he earned a decent income and became, you know, respected and well-known minor celebrity in Japan.
Did Jenkins regret defecting to the North?
Almost immediately, yes. He said for all the time he was there, he thought it was the dumbest thing he had ever done. But then the second chapter of his life, in the one in Japan, he started to reflect on that experience. And this is what he told Blaine Harden in that interview with The Washington Post in 2008.
I don't know if I'd have had a wife as good as I got. And if I didn't go to North Korea, I wouldn't have my daughter. You know, I don't know what I missed in the U.S. by going to North Korea.
So it's a little hard to hear, but he's saying there, you know, he wouldn't have had a wife as good as he had ended up getting. He wouldn't have had his two beautiful daughters. So from that point of view, not knowing what he had missed in the U.S., was at that point content with his decision.
odd story and today a sad story. The world's very own history guy, Chris Wolf, thank you for filling us in on the incredible life of Charles Jenkins, U.S. Army deserter. He died yesterday, age 77. Thanks.
You're welcome, Marco.
A university in Kabul and an attack, one Afghan woman's story, survival, next on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. The American university campus in Kabul, Afghanistan, can seem like an idyllic place until you notice the scars. Have a listen to my BBC colleague Hugh Sykes on a recent visit to the campus.
That is the sound of students playing table tennis here on campus at the American University in Afghanistan. The green lawns of the campus all around, and in the distance, high Afghan mountains. But all around the perimeter of this campus, there are now high, grey blast walls and new yellow watchtowers. There's even one right in the middle of the campus here near one of the lawns. And all this security has been installed since a terrorist attack in August 2016. 16 people were killed, including several students.
Sykes spoke with one young woman, a law student, who survived the attack. Her name is Breshna Muzazai. She's in a wheelchair now and is still recovering from the wounds to her left leg. Here's Breshna's very personal story about what happened that day, her firsthand account, and a warning that some of what she'll recall here can be upsetting.
I was in the mosque, female mosque, here in the campus. When I finished my prayer, I heard gunshots. Then explosion happened. And I heard more gunshots. And then I heard another explosion. And the windows were broken. And even the ceiling fell down on us. So I could not run because I have polio on my right leg since childhood. I walked slowly. I was barefoot. My feet are bleeding. In my way, there was broken pieces of glass. After that, I remember I saw the person. The man, he was standing with a gun. He dressed up like a soldier, like, he didn't look a terrorist to me. I thought he's the security guard of the university. He was holding his gun on me, and when he fired, his bullet hit my leg. I fell down on the ground, and that time I thought that I could not believe that I'm shot, and I thought that I cannot run, so it's better to pretend dead. So I didn't move, and when I started pretending dead, he shot me again. The second bullet hit my toes. The pain was unbearable, but because I was so scared, I didn't want the terrorists to know that I'm alive, so I didn't move. I was still pretending dead. And I was scared that if he can shoot me twice, maybe he will come and shoot me in the head. So I was imagining that maybe he's coming to me and he will put his gun on my head. Then after a few seconds, I heard girls screaming upstairs. When the girl started screaming, one of the guys yelled at the girls and he said, "Don't scream." So then I heard gunshots and then I heard no more scream of girls. I thought all of them are dead because it was so quiet. Then I heard someone's phone was ringing. Then I remember my phone. My phone was close to my face. I was laying down on my right side. I saw the light of my phone. I saw that someone is calling me. I put my hand on my phone so that they don't see the light of the phone. And then they started firing and they were throwing grenades. And my body was shaking. And I was breathing very fast. So I was scared if they see me breathing, they will know that I'm alive. So I took my head scarf and put it in my mouth to slow down my breath. And I was in that hallway for 6 hours after I was shot. And I thought to move myself toward a little bit dark corner of the hallway. But then I thought, if I'll move myself, they will know that I have moved because I was bleeding. So I thought, if I'll move, my blood will leave a line and then they will know that I'm hiding there in the dark. Then I thought, okay, let's wait for someone to get me out of here. I knew that someone will come. I could hear the siren of ambulance coming from outside. I could hear strange sounds, like someone is walking in the hallway on the broken glass. I heard people whispering. They were the policemen. The policemen started firing in the hallway. The bullets were going over my head. I could feel the air of the bullets. A bullet hit my injured toes. Then I moved myself and I saw the police and I waved toward them. And then they walked toward me slowly. When they got closer to the stairs, the gunman threw a grenade from upstairs. Then the policemen backed off. They went back and they left the building. That time I was disappointed. I thought they left me. But then I saw they came again. After 30 minutes, when they entered the building, the policeman told me, pull yourself toward us. And I told the policeman that I cannot move. I'm shot. Then he said, you're like my sister. Just hold my hands. And he put me on his back. My leg was hanging and it was hitting the ground and hitting the leg of the policeman. And he pulled me out of the building. The policeman said that, don't make sounds, be patient. We are almost close to the gate. If you'll make sounds, the gunmen can hear us and they'll shoot us. After that, I remember I saw light. Then I realized that I'm safe now. And the policeman put me in the ambulance. The doctor said that I would be able to walk. And I walk with the help of a walker frame. But I have one more surgery left on my foot.
These people who killed 16 people here that night and really seriously injured you, what do you think of them?
They kill students. They kill people who are not even armed. I don't see them even like humans. It's an inhuman act. Killing innocent people, we can't harm someone. We come here to study, and they kill girls, they kill young people. That's why I don't see them as humans. So that's why I cannot say that I'm mad at them or angry at them.
Wow, there's some perspective. Brezhna Muzazai is a law student at the American University in Kabul. She survived a terror attack on the campus in August of 2016 and shared her story with the BBC's Hugh Sykes. I'm Marco Werman. Over 30 years ago, Saudi Arabia shut the country's movie theaters, but now, a reversal, Saudis can go to the movies again. For this Saudi filmmaker, it's about more than just art.
People need to embrace the love of life and just have fun, and in that way, we can fight extremist ideology.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. After 35 years, Saudi Arabia has lifted its ban on movie theaters. The first theaters are slated to reopen in March. Many people are thrilled with the news, including my next guest.
It is such an amazing moment for art in the Middle East, really.
Haifa Al-Mansour is a Saudi filmmaker. Her film Wajida was the first full-length feature film to be shot entirely in Saudi Arabia and the first made in the kingdom by a woman director. Haifa spoke with me today over Skype from L.A.
You know, Saudi Arabia was very conservative, especially starting the late 70s, because of all the emergence of conservative religious strict ideologies, which prohibited any form of exhibition of art in the public sphere. So entertainment can go a long way in a dry place like Saudi. Mm. People need to embrace the love of life and just have fun. And in that way, we can fight extremist ideology.
What kind of movies do you think will be screened in the theaters? Like, what kind of censorship laws do you expect to see?
Censorship is common across the Arab world, and especially in a place like Saudi. I don't expect nudity, for example. But we have been practicing self-censorship, and we will see, which is like we know what society would accept, what we are conservative people, so we try to maneuver. But I expect a lot of American films, a lot of bad comedy, but a lot of films like Wajda that speaks about the society and young people trying to find their voice. So it's going to be mixture.
Why do you think bad comedies from America?
Not bad. No, I would say blockbuster from America, but bad comedies are from Saudi Arabia. Like, we compare us like Latin Americans. We love big performances and stuff like that.
Yeah. What do you think the impact on Saudi Arabia's film industry will be?
I think it will be amazing. There is a lot of interest in Saudi film because of their cultural significance, and politically Saudi Arabia is important, so a lot of people want to know. But always, like, the question was how commercially viable in the Middle East Saudi films are. And now the equation completely changed, because once they open movie theaters, Saudi films will have a huge box office revenues. And that will give Saudi filmmakers a push and more interest in their stories globally.
I would guess this could have serious impact on kids growing up in Saudi Arabia. Like, suddenly you can go to a movie theater.
I think it will have a huge impact on young people in Saudi, and also families. Like, Saudi Arabian families are big, and every time they want to go to a movie or go to like some kind of entertainment, they have to travel to Dubai or Bahrain, which is like financially expensive for every holiday to travel outside the kingdom. So now this will make things easier for families.
Yeah, flying to the movies, that's an expensive ticket. Do you remember going to the movies yourself in the late 70s and early 80s before movie theaters were banned?
No, I don't remember, actually. My father used to bring us videos or project them on at home. I'm one of 12 kids. I'm number 8. So he had a very busy house. So we would watch a lot of movies on VHS. We would go to Blockbuster. And I remember, like, those video rentals won't allow women because they are corrupt places considered. So they will have a sign, women are not allowed inside. And I will stay outside and I'll ask, they will give me a catalog and I will take the movies I want and the guy will bring them out for me. It was wonderful just to see a lot of movies as a kid and be part of the big world. And I come from a small town in Saudi Arabia. So it is really nice just like to see the world and experience big emotions like falling in love or people fighting for their countries and all those grand emotions that you don't get to experience as in a small town like where I grew up.
And Haifa, why do you live now in Los Angeles? Does that tell us something about your ability to do what you really want to do in Saudi Arabia?
Oh, yeah. We moved to Los Angeles 3 years ago, so I can pursue my career here in Hollywood. And I just finished a film called Mary Shelley, starring Elle Fanning. And I'm working on a film for Netflix right now.
Is this news from Saudi Arabia kind of a moment for you to be thinking about projects you would do in Saudi?
Definitely. I have so many projects to do in Saudi, and we are working on a film about a woman in Saudi who takes a career in politics. And because now women can run for an office, for a municipal office in Saudi Arabia, but still society is very conservative and won't allow it. And still societies are segregated, so they cannot go meet with the people. They have to meet through like video conference or something. And it creates a lot of drama for women if they want to run for an office or something. So I'm working with this again with the same producers we've done Wajda, and we will go back in Saudi.
Haifa Al-Mansour is a Saudi filmmaker. Her film, Mary Shelley, is in production and comes out next year. The best of luck to you, Haifa. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
And now to a story about the power of art in the face of adversity. I read about this a few months back, and it really intrigued me. It's about a man named Kalman Aaron. He's 93 and lives in Los Angeles. And he's a Holocaust survivor who used his skills as an artist to stay alive in the camps and then to create a new life here in the U.S. Saul Gonzalez of station KCRW in Santa Monica paid him a visit.
Hello. Kalman, hi. Nice to see you.
When you step inside Kalman Aaron's modest apartment in Beverly Hills, you're surrounded by a lifetime of creation. Paintings cover every wall of the small apartment. Portraits, landscapes, and abstract works. Many more canvases are stacked a dozen deep on the floor. How many paintings do you think you've done in your life?
In your life, maybe 2,000.
2,000?
2,000.
Kalman was born in Riga, Latvia, in 1924, and started sketching when he was 3. At 13, he won a competition to paint a portrait of the country's prime minister. Then came war and the invasion of Latvia by Nazi Germany. The Nazis sought to imprison and eliminate Latvia's Jewish population.
I wound up in the ghetto.
The Riga ghetto.
And I was like 16 years old.
Many of Kalman's family and friends were killed there and in concentration camps. But he was able to survive when German soldiers discovered his skills as an artist. The Germans asked Kalman to draw or paint them and to make small portraits of family members in exchange for scraps of bread.
I would do a painting, a pastel, mostly pastels, you know, pastel of them, and they would give me some food.
Kalman's artistic skills also helped shield him from grueling slave labor as he was transferred to 7 different prison and concentration camps.
If I didn't have a pencil and paper, I wouldn't be here. So the pencil and paper did it.
They saved your life.
Yeah.
After the war, Kalman lived in a displaced persons camp in Austria and received a scholarship to attend Vienna's Academy of Fine Arts. In 1949, and with only $4 in his pocket, Kalman immigrated to the U.S. with his first wife, settling in Los Angeles. After a stint painting pottery in a factory, Kalman started getting work painting portraits of the city's wealthy, like the family of Susan Bilby McGee.
I'll tell you how I met him. I was 6 years old. My mother saw a painting of his on Wilshire Boulevard, wanted him to come over to paint her daughters. I was just a child having a portrait done.
Decades later, McGee met Kalman again and decided to write a book about him and his art. She says you can trace how Kalman came to grips with the trauma of his wartime experiences by studying how his work changed over the decades.
His landscapes at the beginning of his time in L.A. in the 50s, they're all gray, there's no sun, there's no light, there are no people, there's no color, there's nothing. What I realized was that was his interior landscape when he arrived. 30 years later, he paints the Hollywood Hills, and they're beautiful, full of color.
This is my favorite place.
As he walks me through his apartment dressed in a robe and his trademark blue beret, Kalman is an enthusiastic guide and commentator on his own work.
This is mine, and I call it Kalmanism.
Kalman painted portraits of such figures as Ronald Reagan and author Henry Miller. But McGee says he always tried to avoid too much attention. It's one big reason, she says, his story isn't better known.
One of the ways he survived was drawing in the camps. The other way was he taught himself to be invisible so the guards wouldn't see him. When he came to America, invisibility equated to safety and being visible with death. So he kind of stayed under the radar his entire career.
Kalman still paints, usually at night in a small corner workspace next to his kitchen.
I get interested in something, and then I didn't want to go to bed. Many times I didn't sleep at night, you know. I went on the whole night doing it.
He worked every day.
Kalman's companion is his 4th wife, Miriam, who's from Venezuela.
Every day he's painting. So I had to tell her, okay, Grandma, let's go to work. Okay, Kama, it's lunchtime. Otherwise, he will be there.
If you didn't tell him to do those things, exactly. He'd still be working.
Yeah.
Kalman says his art has saved him more than once. First during the Holocaust, and now that he's 93, it's kept him from something many people his age struggle with.
Boredom. Dying of boredom. I'm still talking, I'm still working. They die of boredom.
And you're saying never get bored.
Absolutely. I'll go to 104. 105 maybe. Because I like doing it, you know.
Yeah.
I couldn't be unhappy if I sit down there and I do something and nobody else has done that. That's what keeps me going.
One big issue that hasn't been resolved is what will happen to Kalman's works after he dies. Those close to him hope his collection, now stacked around his small apartment, will end up in a museum. For The World, Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
Wow. The fate of the coal industry has been roiling politics here in the U.S. for years now. The question is far from settled in Germany, but the country has decided to pull the plug on a big part of its coal industry, its deep underground mines. The last of them will close next year. So what comes next for old coal communities there? Valerie Hamilton has a story of one city that's already looking ahead.
When I started to ask people in Germany about the city of Bottrop in the western Ruhr Valley's coal country, someone told me a joke, one of the same ones you used to hear about New Jersey. I can't repeat it on the radio, but let's just say that Bottrop has a bit of an image problem.
Yeah, it's dirty, it's poor, it's not well educated.
Dorothy Lauter is not the person who told me the joke. She actually works for the city, and it's her job to change Bottrop's reputation, to try to make over an image that for decades was literally set in stone. Coal has defined Bottrop for over 150 years. Over that time, the workers and machines at this mine, called Prosper Haniel, have produced more than 300 million tons of hard coal. It's one of more than 100 such mines that helped make Germany an industrial powerhouse. But that era is coming to an end. Climate-conscious Germany still burns coal, but it's under pressure to quit. In the meantime, underground coal mining here can't compete with cheaper imports. Prosper Haniel is one of two hard coal mines left in the whole country. When state subsidies end next year, they're closing. Lauter says the loss is taking a toll.
This whole region was kind of in a depression, you could say.
In Germany, it's not alone. The whole country's identity as a smokestack economy is changing. Germany's in the midst of a green energy revolution. It's ramping up renewables to slash carbon emissions, aiming for nearly carbon neutral energy, transportation, and buildings by 2050. So Bottrop decided to join the parade.
We thought it's a good idea for the city that has an image for the old energy to actually become a city of new energy.
They started by giving a miner's neighborhood an energy makeover. Old houses got new insulation. School bus stops got efficient LED lights. And Bottrop began promoting itself as Innovation City. Today, this is not your coal mining grandpa's Bottrop. Downtown is paved with special bricks that absorb air pollution. Solar-equipped houses pump electricity into the grid. There are plans for electric buses, even a wind-powered sewage plant. Bottrop says CO2 emissions are down by more than a third since 2010. Even some people who built their lives on coal support the transition. Klaus Kolasse is a retired coal miner who lives just down the street from the mine. He's got a big brick house with a little dog and a swing set for his grandkids. Down in the basement, he shows me a new energy-efficient heating system he got from the city. He says he likes what Bottrop is doing to go green. He gets that coal is history. The world is changing, he says. When he sees all these weather disasters on TV, he wonders sometimes, did coal cause that? But he says the mine will be missed. It gave people jobs, he says. And so far, the new green Bottrop hasn't.
Yes, that would be a huge challenge.
Bottrop's cleaning itself up. But Dorothy Lauter says there's still a coal-shaped hole in its economy.
The challenge is that the jobs are gone. So you have 2,500 jobs, and the young people that used to go into these jobs can't go into these jobs anymore.
Bottrop needs thousands of new jobs, but its makeover has created just 300 so far. The hope is, eventually, green business will pick up where coal left off. So the region has opened a new technical college in Bottrop to train the next generation of workers, not in coal, but in green tech, water management, electromobility.
It's not that you have to have resentments against new energy because of the decline of the mining industry. Using renewable energy and reducing CO2 can actually be part of your transformation.
That transformation isn't over. But Bottrop has managed to transform its image from punchline to prize winner. It's won Europe-wide sustainability awards 3 years in a row, and its climate-friendly redevelopment has become a model for 20 other cities. Next year, Bottrop is going to the finals in a national sustainable development contest. The prize would be millions in public money to plow back into remaking this old coal city for a greener future. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Bottrop, Germany.
Tomorrow, a possible life after death for the old Bottrop coal mine. A local scientist hopes to turn it into a gigantic storage battery for solar and wind power. That's tomorrow here on the show. The Pentagon says it will comply with a ruling by a federal judge yesterday allowing transgender people to enlist in the U.S. military starting January 1st. It's a setback for President Trump and his ban on transgender recruits, but for Kristen Beck, it's a personal victory. Beck was a member of the Navy's elite SEAL Team 6. She served for more than two decades, earning a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. Beck left the military in 2011 and later came out as transgender. Trump announced the ban back in July, and two judges have ruled against it. For Beck, just following the back and forth on the various legal rulings has been emotionally exhausting.
I've been helping the Pentagon right now on the policies and the handbooks and things for the acceptance and how to make sure it's a smooth sail for open service for transgender people. So we're on like draft number 27 for some of these policies. So there's a lot of people working really hard trying to make this happen. And then they stop, and then they start it back up again, then they stop. That's just not the way to run a government.
Yeah. I mean, some of your close friends are still serving in the U.S. military and are transgender. What are they telling you at this point about how they're dealing with the whole back and forth?
Yeah, it's extremely upsetting, but they kind of see it as just the path and trailblazing. And so one of my friends is an Apache helicopter pilot. She's serving, and she's in South Korea right now, as a matter of fact. She's extremely qualified, and they need her, and they need many other folks across the spectrum of the services, and they're transgender. Highly qualified, highly trained, a lot of effort and capability in these people. You're going to say no, no more service? Doesn't make any sense.
So some of us will know your story, others won't. Can you just remind us of your service?
I served 13 tours in Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, and a few other spots. Did a lot of combat operations. So I received a Purple Heart in 2008 for some stuff. So
you're being very self-deprecating, I think.
I did my service, and I was really good as a Navy SEAL. I paid attention, and I worked hard, and showed up on time in the right uniform, did my job. We're not robots. We do have minds, but we have great capability, and we do follow orders. We're disciplined.
You're a decorated veteran. What motivated you to try to make it into the Navy SEALs?
As I was growing up, you know, I'm being bullied as a kid, and then finding out that I could beat the bullies up. You know, I just figured that's what I wanted to do. And so for me, it would be either going into law enforcement or the military. And so I chose the military, and the toughest branch in the military was the Navy SEALs. So I'm going to keep on beating those bullies up. So,
do you think there's a public misperception about who the Navy SEALs are?
A lot of times there are. Most of us are about 5'10" and 180 pounds. You know, I mean, we're scrappy. We can run marathons and then, you know, climb up a tower and then swim 7 miles. The marathon runner type of a person. So after you run 50 miles and you still have to swim 5 miles, think of the person that can do that.
Does that describe you, Kristen? 5'10", 180 pounds?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just about exactly.
So when you were with SEAL Team 6, you were not out. And for two decades, you served beside colleagues in the most extreme and dangerous conditions. How could you conceal something so central to your identity? And what was that like?
Even right now, you know, for me, it's a spiritual thing. It's an intellectual journey more than it's a physical journey, which is almost diametrically opposite than that person, Caitlyn Jenner. So for me, this is more of my growth, you know, and maybe this is my challenge, is to change that perception about gender and capability, that we are all capable, and as human beings, that we are all spiritually the same, and we have to start treating each other that way. Now, if you judge me just by my appearance, if you judge me based on my gender or my color or anything about me, just that surface piece, you're going to miss everything else. You're going to miss so much of a depth of a person. So we just need to stop judging on all these superficial attributes.
Surely, though, you've run into many, many people who don't get what you're about. Have you ever encountered a person with that mindset and said, I'm going to introduce you to who I am? And like, how did that go?
It's probably the most difficult thing you could ever do. And it was for members especially.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you have somebody who's a complete stranger or somebody who's just a friend and they turn their back on you and they say, oh, I'm not going to accept you. You know, they're basically looking at you and saying you're not worthy, that you are less than human. They push you away just for something, you know, as silly as gender. So family members are tough, because if you have a family member turn their back on you, throw you out. And I know this happens a lot to teenage kids who are part of the LGBT community. Mm.
Yeah, did that ever come close to happening to you?
Well, my mom, for about a year, I wasn't able to go to the house. She said I wasn't invited. And it just took some time for her to understand, you know, this was a lot more than just putting on some different clothes or being looking a little different on the outside. This is a lot deeper than that. And then once she realized that, then she was like, okay.
Kristen, as you know, critics of transgender service talk about the loss of unit cohesion, lack of readiness, tremendous medical costs for transition surgery. Is there no merit in any of those concerns?
There's a little bit of merit. It's just like when you have the half-truths and total false things, when you put that little nugget of truth in there, and it makes people grab onto that. So as far as the money goes, yeah, it's going to cost some money. But it's not going to cost even one-tenth of what it costs to buy Viagra for the military each year. And then when you talk about unit cohesion and readiness. So if you take that example of the Apache helicopter pilot that I know.
Right.
So she's trained and she's a trainer. She's very advanced in the Apache squadrons. And if you take her away, you're taking away millions and millions of dollars of training and readiness because she is a trainer. So she's getting everybody else trained up. And right now, why would you do that? We're already short helicopter pilots in the Army. You're going to take away more? And she's just one. There's a few, another dozen.
Kristen Beck was a member of the Navy SEAL Team 6, earning a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. She's the author of Warrior Princess, A U.S. Navy SEAL's Journey to Coming Out Transgender. Visibility is just a small part of trans representation. Here's the world's Brandi Fulwood with a musical selection that deals with just that.
I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but I think your inside is your best side.
Scottish DJ Sophie is known for creating intricate songs and digital sounds that seem to interact with the physical world. Bursting bubbles, sipping lemonade, crumbling tinfoil, and styrofoam. For a long time, very few people knew anything about the person behind the music. But now she's released a new track, It's Okay to Cry, and a stunning video that brings her trans identity to the fore.
I remember one time you were lost. Find you, and I knocked on your front door. That was you I'd never seen before.
It's Okay to Cry is different from what Sophie fans are used to, but it is an emotional ballad that explores so many textures, both industrial and saccharine. It even explores misty enclosed spaces that suddenly burst open at the end.
It's okay to cry. Was that a teardrop in your eye?
With Sophie, there are so many more details to come back to and explore. For the world, I'm Brandi Fulwood.
And that's where we're going to leave it today, from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.